So I think this sounds like a really crazy principle, but I think that it may turn out to be a correct description of how we select actions. There's this big question: how these micro changes are orchestrated in the whole brain, and how they together result in learning in the distributed network of brain areas. And I think this is the place where the theory inspired by deep learning can bring a lot of insight.
This is Brain Inspired.
And so I say to you, my fellow truth seekers, ask not what backpropagation can do for neuroscience. Ask what neuroscience can do for backpropagation.
You may have recognized that from a famous speech long ago. It's possible I altered some of the words there. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Paul Middlebrooks. My guest today is Rafał Bogacz. He is a professor at University of Oxford, where he leads a group of researchers focused on understanding the information processing and the dynamics of neural activity that underlie decision-making and what goes wrong therein in neurological disorders. Rafał has mostly worked with computational models and simulations in this regard, but he's recently become interested in how backpropagation may be approximated in brains. And today we talk about his recent review article on that topic in Trends in Cognitive Science with his co-author James Whittington. Talk during the show in broad terms about what we know about how brains learn by changing the strength of connections between neurons called synaptic plasticity, and how machines learn these days by changing network weights between units via backpropagation, and how the brain might implement some version of backpropagation or some approximation of backpropagation, which has proven so efficient and useful in machines. We also revisit the free energy principle and predictive coding, which we've talked about on the show here multiple times now. But you free energy principle nuts out there might enjoy hearing about it once again. Today, we talk about it in terms of what a predictive coding framework would look like, implementing an approximation to backpropagation in the brain, which is what got Rafał interested in the first place in this question. That is part of the larger picture of how backprop might be approximated by brains, and we cover the various proposed mechanisms they describe in the review paper, although it's by no means an exhaustive survey on the topic. One of those mechanisms is by encoding errors in apical dendrites, which we discuss more in depth in the episode. But to learn even more about that, I would also refer you to episode 9 with Blake Richards, where we talk about his and others' work modeling how that could work in dendrites. Rafał and I also today talk about the merits of looking for different kinds of computations in different brain regions. Rafał waxes poetic about the free energy principle and its broader implications. And of course, we cover a lot more. Find links to the stuff that we discuss in the show notes at braininspired.co/podcast/32. Anand, Wally, Henrik, Scott, when I see any of you, I will put you on a balcony and serenade you. Thanks for supporting the show through Patreon and or PayPal, both of which you can find on braininspired.co if you find it within your means to contribute $2 or $4 per month to the show. Thanks for listening, guys. I have a lot more great guests lined up in the near future, but for now, please enjoy the delightful, insightful Rafał Bogacz. Rafał, it is great to have you here. Thanks for being with me today on the show.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
So I will have introduced you more in the introduction here, but just very briefly, you're a professor at the University of Oxford, and you lead a group that models information processing and decision-making in our brains. And I know you from your work on decision-making and assessing different models for how perceptual decisions get made, asking which models are the most efficient, make the most sense, you know, in various conditions, are the most optimal, and your work relating these models to known properties in brain circuits like those in basal ganglia and the cortex, and your work on the speed-accuracy trade-off, which actually played a big part in one of my colleagues' research on that topic. So thanks for that in general. But recently, you have spent some time focusing on like the free energy principle and predictive coding.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote a really nice mathematical tutorial that's very accessible on the subject. And we'll talk predictive coding a bit today. But the big topic really for today's show is how the brain might implement something like backpropagation. Now, based on your body of work, my guess is that you are mostly concerned with optimization and efficiency.
Yes.
in brains and models. So, okay. So if that is correct, so how would you characterize your approach and what drives your interests?
So as you mentioned, we are very much interested in the idea that the brain is performing computations close to optimality. So you can make an argument that there was always an evolutionary pressure for the brain to perform optimal or efficient computation. So the animals which had brain, which were performing computations more efficiently, had larger chances for survival. And the same can be applied not only to decision making, but also to learning. So the models which are able to learn better have higher chances of being implemented in the brain. And as you mentioned, my previous interest and the interest of my group was in the models of decision making. So we wanted to know how the brain made decisions, but also how the brain decisions should be made in a given circumstances. And this is how we kind of enter the world of learning, the world of predictive coding, and our interest in the deep learning.
So, you know, like we just discussed, you've recently focused on the free energy principle and predictive coding. And we'll come back to this a little bit when we talk about an approach that you've taken to modeling backpropagation in the brain. But just to kind of start out, I kind of want your broad thoughts about the free energy principle. This is an exciting sort of, it's gaining excitement, it seems. Do you feel like this is the way forward for like a general principle of the brain? You know, I mean, maybe you can just describe the free energy principle in broad terms and then judge it.
Okay, so you had a very nice show on free energy principle where you interviewed Sam Gershman, who already presented this very nicely. So as Sam said, a free energy principle is a subset of a Bayesian brain. So it's a way in which brain could implement Bayesian inference. And this is a particular algorithm of how it can do it. And what this principle is saying is that during Bayesian inference, the brain is trying to minimize a particular function called the free energy. And it's difficult to maybe give the equations over the podcast, but as you mentioned, there's a...
I'll refer people to your paper. I'll link to that tutorial paper.
Oh, excellent, yeah. Excellent. What's nice about free energy, it shows how the Bayesian inference can be implemented in a very simple networks of neurons. Because this optimization of free energy can be written as a set of differential equations, which can be then mapped on simple networks of computational elements, which behave like neurons. And one of these networks is the network of Ra and Ballard called predictive coding network. And what it basically assumes, what's the kind of fundamental principle of predictive coding, is that each area of the brain is trying to predict the inputs it receives. And also that the brain has hierarchical organization, and the lowest area could be considered like primary visual cortex, which tries to predict the sensory inputs. And then there are higher areas, which then trying to predict the input from the lower areas, and then they send their expectations for the lowest areas. And what's special about the predictive coding is that the network has a particular implementation, and it includes two types of neurons. So there are neurons which encode expectations and neurons which encode the errors, which is how the observed inputs differ from the expectations. And what the network is trying to do is trying to minimize these prediction errors all the time. So it's trying to minimize the surprise. And this prediction errors are basically minimized in two ways. So the nodes which encode the prediction errors send their errors to other nodes in the hope that somehow this, by changing the activity in the network, the errors can be reduced and the surprise can be resolved. If this is not possible, then errors will drive learning in the network and will drive the changes in synaptic weights. So that parameters of this networks change such that the prediction errors are minimized.
That was a great primer and actually great for what we're going to talk about later with your modeling work. Do you think about, so in models, you do, you just said that there are value units and error units. Do you feel like that that maps onto single neurons in the brain or little populations of neurons? Like, is there a value neuron or is there a value population of neurons that's encoding this? Or do you want to just leave that open? You know.
So this is a very interesting question. How do you actually map this relatively abstract model on the details of the neurobiology? Because, of course, we know about the anatomy of different parts of the brains, and it's very rich, very complex, and also it differs from area to area. So I think that there are some parts of the brain where we know that there are indeed neurons encoding errors. And I think that the best example of this are the is the basal ganglia, where there are neurons. So the basal ganglia is the part of the brain which is very important for making choices, selecting actions, and also learning about the rewards resulting from different actions. So in the basal ganglia, there's this population of dopaminergic neurons, which essentially encode reward prediction errors. So these neurons will have increased firing rate where the animal gets more reward than it expects. I think that in this case, you can try to maybe indeed map the predictive coding networks on this basal ganglia network. And this is, in fact, the focus of my current work. In case of other areas like the cortex, it's less clear if there are separate neurons encoding errors and separate neurons encoding predictions. So we know that there's lots of evidence that neurons increase their activity when there's surprising input coming, but it's not fully clear if there are separate populations of error and prediction nodes. And also, there has been interesting models proposed, and there's a particular model called dendritic error model proposed by João Sacramento and Walter Sen, which suggest that the errors are not encoded in the separate neurons, but in the apical dendrites of pyramidal neurons. So there are ways of mapping the predictive coding, which is like an abstract algorithm, in different ways on the kind of more detailed structures of neurobiology.
Well, Jesus, man, I've already taken us into the weeds here. So let's back up just a little bit, and then we're going to really get into it. So, you know, before we talk about the different approaches to modeling backpropagation in the brain, let's just talk about learning in a very broad sense. What do we know about how learning works in the brain? I mean, is synaptic plasticity, is that the only game in town? Is it the universally accepted way that brains learn at this point?
So I think that there's a lot of evidence that the main mechanism by which the brain learns are the changes in the strength of the synaptic connections between the neurons, which is called the synaptic plasticity. And this evidence comes from studies which show that learning results in changes in synaptic weights. And also, if you prevent changes in synaptic weights by certain interventions, like blocking certain neuromodulators or channels, then you can prevent learning from happening. Yes. But in big brains, like our human brain.
like yours,
where the memory is stored in a distributed way in thousands of synapses, in hundreds of neurons, it's very difficult to pin down this process precisely. However, you can see this much more precisely in case of simple brains, like in case of the insect brains, where a particular memory may be stored in just a handful of synapses on a few neurons. So this approach is, for example, taken here by my colleague Scott Waddell and his group, who studies learning in the insect mushroom body, which is a part of the brain which learns association of odors and rewards. And there we know quite well how this network is organized, and it's very simple. So there's a lot of neurons which represent odors, but they have very sparse encoding. So there's, for each odor, just very few neurons are active. And there's just a handful of neurons which control approach and avoidance of the odors. So this network can be studied very precisely, because if we want to see how the system learns the particular order result should be approached, we know that there's just a few synapses which should change. And so basically, Scott and his group, they will train this animals that particular order results in reward. And then they can see the changes in a small group of synapses, and they see these plastic changes, and then these plastic changes drive the behavior. There's also another important thing to say, that we know a lot about the plasticity happening between two neurons. So neuroscientists very often study this kind of microplasticity rules, how the changes in the synaptic weights depend on the activity of two neurons the synaptic weight connects, and maybe levels of the neuromodulators. And the picture which emerges is that these changes are very diverse. So different types of synapses have different rules, and plasticity between different types of neurons depends on their timing of their activity and levels of the modulators in a very different way. So there's this big picture which emerges, which basically describes these micro rules of synaptic plasticity. But there's this big question, how these micro changes are orchestrated in the whole brain, and how they together result in learning in the distributed network of brain areas. And I think this is the place where the theory inspired by deep learning can bring a lot of insight.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, even just Googling for theories of learning before synaptic plasticity is really, you just don't see anything. I mean, I guess there's some psychological theories, but the only other thing that comes to mind is that the dynamics of the system, which you could almost say is an emergent property of the underlying neurophysiology, that in itself could be implementing some sort of learning rules. And maybe there's a downward causation, right, of the dynamical system doing this overall learning, what you were just talking about, distributed system. There's the answer, right? Well, or maybe not.
No, so I think that you know, there are also other changes which happen during learning. So, for example, the excitability of neurons can change, and this definitely happens.
Right.
But if you think about a neuron has just one parameter describing its excitability, while it has thousands or tens of thousands of parameters describing its synaptic connections.
Right.
So there's just much more information capacity in synaptic connections, much more than in other elements of the neuron.
Okay, so we're on board that synaptic plasticity has something to do with learning in the brain. Okay, so then there are these deep learning networks. So maybe we could just talk real briefly about and broadly about backpropagation, which is the main way that neural networks these days and days of yore are trained. So what is backpropagation? And maybe you could just talk a little bit about how it differs from what we know about brains.
Okay, so I guess most of the listeners know about this, but I will just explain it very briefly. So the backpropagation describes learning in feedforward neural networks, which have some an input layer and output layer. And the network works in a way that when you present an input, it can propagate the activity and generate a particular output. And what you want to achieve during training is that network produces a particular target pattern for the given input pattern. So this network is presented with multiple pairs of target and input patterns, and during the learning, synaptic connections are modified. And the key component or key concept in the learning, in the backpropagation algorithm, is the concept of error associated with each neuron. And this error could be thought as expressing a difference between the activity the neuron produced and the activity it should have produced in order for the network to generate the right target pattern. So this error is very easy to define for the last layer as simply the difference between the target activity and the activity actually produced by the network. And it turns out that this errors can also be defined for the intermediate layer as some function of the errors from the next layer. And this gives name to the algorithm as the backpropagation, because these errors are kind of computed backwards, so they are backpropagated in the network. And the key change which occurs during learning is that synaptic weights are modified proportionally to the errors of the corresponding neurons. And now, probably the main reason why the backprop has been for a long time considered as biologically implausible is that in the standard backpropagation algorithm, the errors are not computed by the network itself, but are computed by an external computer program which simulates the network. So basically, the computer program runs, which simulates the learning, will compute the errors and modify the synaptic weights. While in the brain, the synaptic plasticity only depends on activity of local neurons connected via the synapse. So this is probably the main difference and the main reasons for the critique of the algorithm.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just quote Francis Crick from directly that you quote in the review that you wrote. Despite the apparent simplicity and elegance of the backpropagation learning rule, it seems quite implausible that something like equations are computed in the cortex. And that's from 1989, I believe, is right. Yeah. And the main reason that you just gave is one of those reasons why. There are other reasons as well. I don't know if you want to...
There are other reasons as well. I think that, which were pointed by Francis Crick, such as differences between the biological neurons and the neurons in artificial neural networks, as well as particular patterns of connectivity which are expected from this backpropagation networks and the connectivity in the brain. And I have to also admit that I find it surprising that on the kind of sociological level of sociology of science, that backpropagation algorithm has been considered implausible for so long. Because in fact, the first biologically plausible implementation of backpropagation algorithm, which is really, really nice and has been proposed in 1996 by Randall O'Reilly, who in fact lives in Colorado, as you do.
I hope to interview him sometime, so yeah.
And this is a great work, and he provided a first really convincing demonstration how something like backprop could be implemented with just local plasticity rules and local information. And somehow this work hasn't become very well known outside people working with Randall. And I guess it's partly connected with the fact that by 1996, machine learners lost interest in backprop. So this was the time where basically there was a rise of support vector machines, and maybe just people didn't consider the questions how you can do backprop so interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard a few people say that Randall O'Reilly has just been a few steps ahead of everyone else in multiple facets. So maybe he'll get his due pretty soon here. That was back in the connectionist days, right? Okay, great. Well, so we're about to dive in a little bit here to the different theories of backpropagation. But when we figure out how this does work in brains, and I should say too, is your interest in backpropagation that it itself is an efficient way of training the network? And so you thought, there must be evolutionary pressure on the brain to do something like this? Was it your efficiency flag that went up or what?
No, so okay. So the story why we started to work on this problem was more coincidental. So I've been interested for some time in these free energy networks and how they can be involved in decision making. There was a seminar in Oxford given by Jeff Hinton, who basically talked about deep learning and some of his ideas how deep learning could be implemented, and maybe that there was some backpropagation of information going through connections in the neurons. And during this talk, my colleague Tim Behrens asked a question that, you know, there are all this backward connection in the brain and there are all these neurons representing errors. Surely you could do backprop with this kind of models which describe this. And then after hearing this question and hearing this discussion at the seminar, together with my graduate student James Withington, we thought that, well, we are working on this free energy networks. Can they actually approximate backprop? And we were just got really excited. And for a few weeks, we bounced with the ideas. And indeed, convinced ourselves that they indeed do something like backprop. So this is kind of the way how we started to work on this.
Hmm. That's interesting. I mean, how similar do you think when we figure out how it quote unquote works in the brain, how similar to actual backpropagation do you think that it's going to look?
Okay, that's a very interesting question. So I think that all the models which have been proposed so far, or actually most of the models, don't implement even physically backpropagation. They just approximate it.
Right.
So even our predictive coding model only basically implements backprop in the limit of certain parameters converging to some unusual limits. So all the models approximate backprop and they perform learning which is fulfilling also different goals. So they are not just doing supervised learning. They are trying to fulfill other goals, like reinforcement learning or unsupervised learning. Also, so you want to have a network which is able to perform both supervised, unsupervised learning and reinforcement learning at the same time. And that's a very interesting question, to what extent this network will be similar to Backdrop.
Yeah. I mean, we can probably talk a bit more about it later after we talk about the different theories. I mean, so you talked about the question that Tim asked, and Tim Behrens has been on the show as well. And
yes,
he, it makes me think, you know, the brain is such a beautiful mess. There are so many different ways that you could get to Backprop, but like you said, under lots of various constraints. And there's such a vast array of neurons and circuitry and a vast array of constraint possibilities that you could implement that it's almost, let me phrase it this way. When we figure out how something like backpropagation is approximated in the brain, do you think that people like the neural network people are going to say, ah, see, we came up with this and we knew how brains work, and the neuroscientists and neuroscientist modelers just followed our lead, and so we should take the reins here, us AI theorists. Who's going to get credit for this, Rafael? Who's going to get credit?
That's a interesting question. So maybe first to answer the first part of the question. So I think that when we figure out how the brain works eventually, the solution will also look slightly different for different parts of the brain. Yeah, so the brain is not very uniform, and maybe the solution for cortex, for hippocampus, for basal ganglia, for cerebellum will look slightly differently. And so there will be just not one uniform solution. Well, who will take credit? I think this is a distributed effort, and I think that both neuroscientists and machine learners can influence each other and inspire each other.
The correct answer was our current United States President Trump will take credit. Okay, moving along. Theories of error back propagation in the brain. It's a really nice review that you wrote with James Whittington?
Yes.
James Whittington. So let's get into this. So what are some of the guiding principles to help us evaluate what a good model would even look like of backpropagation in the brain?
So I think that there are two sets of these principles. The first are connected with efficiency. So we want models which actually can work, which can actually learn some benchmark task which we humans are able to learn, or our visual systems are able to learn. So you know, several models have been proposed in the past which are biologically plausible and quite simple, but maybe they don't scale very well for larger problems, are unable to learn even this kind of like benchmark problems like classification of written handwritten digits.
Right.
So efficiency is one set, but there's also a second set of constraints connected with biological plausibility. Yes. So I think that at the first instance, at the first approach, we want to see models which are able to perform local computations. So all the neurons just get information from other neurons, and all the synaptic weights are just modified on the base of information provided by the neurons they connect, and maybe some one global signal which could be encoded by neuromodulators. We want the networks which work autonomously, where you don't have to have a little homunculus which rewires the networks in different phases in different ways.
Right.
And we want to have a networks which have their architectures, the pattern of connectivity, which are similar to those seen in the brain. And I think that this is the kind of the first step. And then, you know, once we identify this kind of candidates, I think the real fun will start when we try to map this networks on the details of the biology. So, you know, long term, in the next maybe 5 to 20 years, you would like to be able to take these networks which have been proposed and map them on the actual neural circuits, on the actual anatomically known populations.
Are we going to end up with models that just replicate brains? You know, what's the limit of where are we going to stop and say, okay, this is good enough? We can defer.
No, I think it's a very interesting question, and you know it's connected with the question: what insights from neuroscience, machine learning, should take on board? Yes. So As you know, it has been proposed in computational neuroscience that the models can be built on different levels. So there are this, 3 levels of MAR, the computational, algorithmic, and implementation levels.
Yes. Right.
And I think that you can describe the computations of the learning networks in the brain in the form of the computation performance, in the form of the algorithm, and in the form of the detailed implementation. And for different people, different levels are interesting. So if you really want to understand just the overall algorithm, maybe you don't want to dive into the algorithm, into the details of the biology. But I think for neuroscientists, it's really important to understand what is actually the function of the different subtypes of neurons they observe under their microscopes and record from.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I keep derailing us with these sort of broader pictures here.
Oh, fascinating questions.
So in the paper, you really separate 2 main categories of models that try to tackle this modeling backpropagation in the brain: temporal error models and explicit error models. And of course, as you note in the paper, these aren't the only kinds of models that exist, but these are just the ones that you focus on in the paper. So maybe you can just walk us through in broad terms what a temporal error model is and what an explicit error model is and how they differ.
So the temporal error models represent errors as the difference in activity in time. So they would have an architecture which, in addition to feedforward connections, which are present in standard artificial neural networks, also have feedback connections. And because the network is recurrent, they are described by a set of differential equations which describe the evolution of these neuron-like nodes across time. And the key insight of the temporal error models is that you can essentially separate the error as a difference in activities across time. So so the error is defined as the difference between activity which you want the neuron to produce and the activity the neurons actually produced. So you can basically, instead of changing the synaptic weights proportionally to the error, you can modify them twice. Once with the target present, and once without the target. And so when the target is present, you modify it proportionally to the activity the network should have produced. And when the target is not present, you modify them in a way inversely proportional to the activity the network actually produced.
So it's like a two-step process.
Yes, you have a two-step process. You first unlearn existing association between the input and output, and then you learn the new association. So basically, in terms of its implementation, these models predict that you would have synaptic weights which are modified twice during learning. Once in a way which is inversely proportional to the activity, which neuroscience would be called antihebbian. And then when the target is provided, they are modified in a way which is proportional to the activity, which would be called hebbian. And what's kind of really appealing about these temporal error models is that they are very simple, and they have very simple plasticity rule and very simple dynamics, but they have a drawback that they require a control signal which tells the network in which phase of activity it is. Is it the phase without the target present or the phase with target? Because in different phases, the rules of the plasticity should be different. And you may also even have a problem that maybe the target never arrives.
It's not an intuitive way to me of thinking about it.
Yes. So basically, it has been proposed by Randall and other that maybe this solution for this problem of these phases could be provided by oscillatory rhythms. So in a certain part of the brain, like in the hippocampus, you have these very strong oscillations. And maybe in one phase of the oscillation, you don't provide the target pattern. In another, you do. And then you can control the plasticity according to the phase of those oscillations. Mm-hmm. But there's no clear evidence that such phases exist in other parts of the brain. So therefore, it's also interesting to consider the other type of models, which are the explicit error models. And the explicit error models would have slightly more complicated network architecture, which will include some additional elements which represent the errors explicitly.
Well, that's okay, because the brain is complicated.
Yes.
Right? Maybe we could just talk about a couple of the examples of the explicit error models. So I had Blake Richards on the show kind of early on, so it was a long, long time podcast-wise now. But so we talked about his work and others' work using apical dendrites to model the error explicitly in a neuron. And basically the way that this works is you have a neuron and it has these basal dendrites, this big net that projects pretty locally to the neuron body. And it's receiving inputs from one region of the brain and local feedback connections. And then you have this long extending apical dendrite that extends up into different layers of the brain and is receiving input from different regions. And because of this separation of the dendrite from the neuron cell body, it can perform different computations of these incoming signals and lead to different properties, different plasticity changes in the way that that neuron fires. I think that's the general gist of it. Mm-hmm. Is there anything to add to that sort of model, the dendritic model?
Yeah, so this is a very good description of how the network, how a single neuron works. And then there's an interesting question, you know, how you connect this kind of neurons into a multi-layer networks and how they communicate with each other. And I think that a very nice answer to this question has been provided by a model to which I refer as dendritic error model, which was developed by João Sacramento and Walter Sen. Where they propose a particular architecture of the network. So this network is organized into a layer, into layers, and within each layer, the apical dendrite will calculate the error, and it calculates the error as the difference between the feedback from the layer above and the local prediction of what this feedback should be, which is generated by a network of interneurons. So there's a network of interneurons which kind of generates a prediction what the feedback should be given from the layer above. And this prediction is compared with the actual feedback given to the apical dendrite in the apical dendrite itself. And then when this prediction is high, then this activity in the apical dendrite can drive plasticity in the network. And this will closely approximate micropropagation. So what we point out in this review paper in Trends in Cognitive Science is that this dendritic error network is closely related to predictive coding network. So it has lots of similarities in a sense that it also has a separate representation of error as explicit, in this case, dendrites, not the error nodes. And in fact, we show that you can essentially rewrite the mathematical equation describing predictive coding in a different equivalent way. And this different equivalent way can be mapped on this dendritic error model. So this dendritic error model could be viewed as an alternative way of implementing the computation of the predictive coding networks.
The predictive coding network that you're talking about is one that you actually worked on and the other one that you describe in the paper. You already described what predictive coding is and the free energy principle. Maybe you can describe a little bit the model that you made and how predictive coding without these constraints can be used to approximate backpropagation.
Okay. So, as I mentioned before, just a few minutes ago, the predictive coding networks also have this hierarchical organization. And in each level of hierarchy, you have two types of neurons, neurons encoding the predictions and neurons encoding the errors. And they essentially communicate with each other through the neurons encoding errors. And in the original work of Rao and Ballard, the predictive coding networks were developed for unsupervised learning. So what Rao and Ballard tried to do is they demonstrated that these networks can be used to learn the representation of visual stimuli. So you can learn, the network can learn to predict what features are present in visual stimuli and build a representation of this. So these models were used for unsupervised learning. So what James Whittington and I realized is that although these models are actually very old and they were developed in 1989, nobody has tried to use them for supervised learning. And if you take these networks and instead of just constraining them on one end, on the kind of bottom level of the network, you also constrain them on the top level, these networks very closely approximate a backpropagation algorithm. So basically, these networks have the property that when you just constrain the top level and let the network predict its output, it will generate exactly the same pattern of activity as artificial neural network with equivalent weights. By contrast, if you constrain both ends of this network, both the one end and the other end, and let the network relax, then the network will modify its connections in exactly the same way as in artificial neural networks. Yes. So the rule for the weight modification in predictive coding is that weight modification is proportional to this prediction errors. Mm. And when you just provide the pattern on one end of these networks, this pattern will propagate, and all the and because the other end is unconstrained, all the prediction errors will converge to zero. So there will be no weight modification. While when you constrain both ends of this network, these prediction errors don't have freedom to decay to zero. So there are some errors which cannot be explained, and these errors lead to weight modification. So what is kind of particularly appealing about these predictive coding networks is that they work in a completely autonomous way. So you don't have any control. You don't have to specify, you know, in which phase they are. You just provide patterns. And if you just provide pattern on one end, the network will make a prediction. If you provide patterns on two ends, the network will essentially learn to associate them.
Huh. So, Rafael, how are we going to have to wait until we have nanoparticles embedded in all of our neurons and can record from every neuron simultaneously and somehow analyze that data to really determine which of these models is the better candidate and how backpropagation actually works? Or how can we determine this stuff experimentally right now, you know?
So the models make different experimental predictions. And I think that these predictions could be roughly grouped in two classes. So they make predictions about the activity and how the activity of neurons depend on errors in the network or surprise in the stimuli. So the predictive coding models assume that there are neurons which explicitly encode errors. The dendritic error models assume that the errors are encoded in dendrites and the neurons will produce bursts of spikes when the errors are present, while the temporal error models do not actually make any explicit prediction of neurons increasing their activity with error. And as I mentioned before, there is evidence that at least in some brain areas, there are neurons which clearly encode errors or increase the activity with errors.
Sure.
And then the second class of predictions are connected with plasticity. So different models predict different types of plasticity. So for example, this contrastive learning, this temporal model, which I described, makes this prediction that the sign of plasticity should be different depending whether the target pattern is present or not, or if you think that this is implemented in a neural oscillation, on the phase of the neural oscillation. And indeed, there is some evidence suggesting that the sign of the plasticity in the hippocampus depends on this phase of the theta cycle. Also, these different models, and I think that we go through this in detail in our transient cognitive science review, that different models make different predictions on the type of the spike time dependent plasticity. And what we see is that different models would predict different types of spike time dependent plasticity. But as I mentioned at the beginning, different types of synapses in the brain actually exhibit different types of spike time dependent plasticity. So there's a big variety. So it's not, if you just look at the existing data, it doesn't seem that, you know, there's just one model which is most consistent with all data. It seems that all these kind of models are consistent with some pieces of data which have been proposed. So, you know, maybe one way of thinking about this is not that we have to look for one model. Maybe these models are not just competing theories, but maybe they are just describing different motives which are combined by the brain. Yes? So you can imagine that different parts of the brain will be better described by different models, which are kind of specialized for different operations. And maybe some parts of the brain will combine different models together.
Yeah, you guys talk about it in the paper. I mean, you basically admit, look, the brain is really complicated and there's room for all of this diversity and these different ways of doing it, as you were just saying. So I meant to say that up at the top, but you just said it for me. So thanks. So what do you think are the, I mean, do you really think that it's going to turn out that way, that there are going to be different ways of implementing this in different brain areas and some areas that implement them together? You know, What is your outlook or opinion? I mean, I know that these are very speculative things.
Yes, so I think this is exactly my thinking at the moment. So, for example, the temporal models have this advantage of simplicity, but they have this kind of drawback that they require this information, whether the target pattern is present or not. So they may be particularly suitable to describe information processing in the brain areas which make predictions for the future, where the target pattern always arrives. For example, like the hippocampus is very well known to deal with space. So maybe it's trying to predict where will I end up in the next time frame. So this information about the next time frame always arrives. Now, the maybe the explicit error models are more suitable for tasks where the target presence is uncertain in time, such as, for example, learning about the rewards or outcomes of different events. And even different types of explicit models have different trade-offs among them. So I think that we talk a little bit about this in the paper, that the drawback of the predictive coding models is that they are actually slow to propagate, because in the predictive coding model, you have to propagate information via error neurons. So you have like twice as many synapses to transmit information as you actually have layers in the artificial neural networks. So these networks are slow.
But you know, this is the knock on brains from computer scientists, is how slow they are. But come on, it's parallel. So we can do it all in parallel. So it's relatively fast and efficient, even so, right?
Yes, yes. But even even if you do a lot of computation in the in parallel, you still have computation in the predictive coding network, which has to go through the layers.
Right,
and from layer to layer, you have to go via this error nodes in the predictive coding architecture, which basically introduces delays. But on the other hand, the dendritic error networks have this drawback that they have this additional network which generates local predictions of the top-down input. And these networks have to be pre-trained. So so basically you need a little bit, so the predictive coding networks are slower to propagate information but faster to train, while the dendritic errors networks may be faster to propagate but slower to train. So basically by merging the two types of networks in the cortical circuits, you can essentially beat the trade-off and maybe initially use the predictive coding networks to learn fast and then kind of consolidate this information with time in these dendritic error models to allow faster information processing.
But that's different than having a control signal which tells the system which learning strategy to use at different times, right? Because they're kind of working in accordance with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so of course there's a non-trivial question is how you actually integrate them, how you build this kind of combined models. Also in the paper, we point out that, you know, it may seem a little bit daunting and depressing that there is this big diversity of the brain and big diversity of the model. So we reveal four models in the paper, which on the first sight look very different. You use different network architectures, different plasticity. But we also point out that what's really nice, that there's this one mathematical framework called equilibrium propagation, in which all these models can be described. So all these models can be described in a framework which considers networks, which during their evolution minimize an energy function. And this framework prescribes how synaptic weights should be modified in this kind of models. And remarkably, all these different models actually follow this framework. So although they are very different, they have like a common mathematical description.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, so I should say that the framework was developed by Benjamin Selyer and Joshua Benjo. And I think it's really important because it can essentially give you a recipe how to modify synaptic weights in any network which has the dynamics which optimizes energy. And so what is meant by optimizing energy is that when you have a network which during the evolution will converge to some equilibrium, and you can describe this equilibrium in a way, in a function which is minimized in this equilibrium, this network will fall into this framework. And
well, the equilibrium is just a minimal energy level.
Exactly.
Right?
Equilibrium is the minimum energy level. So I think that, you know, this framework could be used to basically drive the research on the mapping of this deep learning net architectures on the brain. So, for example, you can have a candidate model which is based on the anatomy of the brain circuits. And for this candidate model, you can figure out what would be the corresponding energy function and then use this framework to suggest the synaptic plasticity rules. And then you can compare the synaptic plasticity rules to the rules which are actually found in these cortical networks. And then through this iterative process, you can essentially refine the models. So it's really nice that, you know, in addition to this kind of abundance and complexity, there's this nice, simple and general principle which kind of can describe the learning rules in all these models.
Yeah, that really is nice. What do you think is one of the biggest hurdles right now to figuring this stuff out in the brain? Is it just the diversity, like we were just talking about? Even though the equilibrium principle you know, brings it all into 1-4. But what do you view as maybe the biggest hurdle figuring out how backpropagation might happen in the brain?
So I think that, as I mentioned before, maybe the question should be how the backpropagation is implemented in a particular part of the brain. Maybe we should not think about this as a kind of general algorithm, which will be the same in all different systems, but start with systems. So I personally really like the basal ganglia, as I mentioned before, which is a relatively simple brain circuit, which has performs a quite complex function, like action selection and learning about the rewards. And it has also a hierarchical organization. It's kind of organized in several loops, which go from more abstract to most motor. And this is an example of the system where we know the anatomy very well. We know very well what are the key neurons, how they are connected. And of course, we don't know all the details, but you know, we have that big picture. And this is the place where we can essentially already now, I think, try to do this mapping of the algorithm on the structure. And I think that it would take maybe slightly more to do similar mapping in more evolutionary newer areas like the neocortex, which are more complex. So, you know, the truth is that we still don't understand the neurobiology and anatomy and physiology of this different structure. So we know that there's this anatomy with the six layers, but we don't understand the response properties of this neuron to the extent, for example, we understand in the basal ganglia. So great progress is being made in this respect. So there's great work by George Keller, for example, in Switzerland, who describes the neurons responding to errors and to unexpected violation of expectations in the cortex and how these responses arrive. So, and I think that thanks to the new tools of neuroscience, like the optical imaging and tools allowing manipulation of the circuits, we will get this picture very soon, which will allow us to do this mapping. So I'm optimistic, and I think that probably we will... Well, I just submitted a grant proposing that we will crack this basal ganglia within 5 years. And in case any reviewers are listening, I'm sticking to this. But, you know, it will probably take slightly more for the cortex.
Well, when you get your grant reviews, we'll see how optimistic you are then.
And, yes.
But it's interesting because everyone is in love these days with the cortex and compares deep learning to different areas in cortex. And no one in the AI world really talks, or, you know, even on the that straddles the AI and neuroscience world, really pays much attention to subcortical areas, however, and to older regions of the brain. But it really might be some of these regions. And I know that areas like the cerebellum, like the basal ganglia, like you were just talking about, even like hippocampal structures, which I guess is technically cortex, but older and sort of lower. And that these might really be the major players, these older regions, in implementing different aspects, different ways of implementing different kinds of backpropagation, like learning in the brain. So I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Yeah, but I fully agree. Of course, the cortex is fascinating because it's the, you know, the area which...
makes us special.
Yes, make us special. Yes, so we want to understand it, but there are these other areas, and so I talked a lot about the basal ganglia, but cerebellum is another really, really interesting area. And what's special about cerebellum is that in cerebellum there are special neurons which encode errors, and which basically for each Purkinje cell, which is the main neuron in cerebellum, there exists a corresponding neuron encoding errors. And this neuron sends an axon just to this one Purkinje cell and to its associated interneurons. So basically, it's a system where you can see this kind of like representation of separate representation of neurons making predictions and neuron generating errors, which is, for example, present in this predictive coding networks.
Yeah. Well, that's I think one of the reasons why subcortical structures in general and older structures in general might be of interest is because they're so conserved and the motifs, the circuitry, is much more straightforward in many cases. So you can really make crisper predictions, perhaps, and see how it will actually turn out.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, our basal ganglias have exactly the same anatomy as the basal ganglia of fish. So it hasn't changed much through evolution. So if you have a part of the brain which hasn't changed for so long, it probably suggests that, you know, it's doing something really useful. It's kind of optimized in a very good way.
So for the listeners who can't see Rafael, but Every time he says basal ganglia, I actually see his gums. He smiles so wide that I see his gums every time. So I don't know if that comes through in the audio. Well, Rafael, do you think that like solving how the brain implements approximate back propagation, do you think that that will actually improve our AI systems, our deep networks and other AI systems?
So when I was an undergraduate studying computer science, my view was definitely yes. And then I remember I had this great conversation with my project advisor, Professor Christophe Girard-Carrier, who told me, this old story about, taking inspiration in artificial intelligence from nature is similar to taking inspiration when people were building aeroplanes. So when people were building aeroplanes, they noticed that, there are these creatures which fly, birds, and they have wings. And it's probably really great to add wings to aeroplanes. And this is really great insight. but then they noticed also that the birds flap wings. And the early aeroplanes tried to flap wings, and this was not such a good engineering solution. You can actually can realize that actually you can build propeller, which is a much simpler solution. And the only reason why birds don't have propellers is that propeller has a disjoint part, so there would be no way to deliver blood to the propeller in case of birds. So, so there is an extent to which it's useful to take inspiration from the from nature, and maybe it's useful to take inspiration to solve a general problems, but not maybe to look at the details of the implementation. And I think the same is, with artificial intelligence. I think that there are still some areas where we still need inspiration from the brain, like the autonomy of artificial agents. But maybe we shouldn't look at details of the implementation. So I mentioned this kind of like MAR levels of implementation. I think it's really nice to take the inspiration from the computations made by the brain and the algorithms it uses, but maybe the things which excite me, like the anatomy of the striatal circuits and the rules of the synaptic plasticity, are not so relevant.
So in your analogy, I suppose back propagation would be the propeller solution to deep neural networks, whereas our brains would be the flapping wings.
Exactly.
Was that?
Yes.
Oh, thank God I got it right. Yeah. that's a really nice analogy, actually. Okay. So you have the solution, back propagation, right? And now you have all these neuroscientists and theorists like yourself, and this is not a knock on you or anyone doing this work, but who are, seeing, okay, this is great. It works really efficiently. Let's see how this happens in the brain. Do you think that that's taking too seriously the implementation in artificial systems and applying it to brains, or maybe not seriously enough? Do you think that neuroscientists and computational neuroscientists in general are taking these AI developments too seriously, or maybe even not seriously enough?
So I think that there is a big need for the theory in neuroscience.
There's need for experimentation. Theories are everywhere. the experimenters are trying to keep up. Sorry to interrupt.
You could say this, but if you go to the meeting of the Society of Neuroscience and you look, what fraction of posters are theoretical? It's just a tiny fraction in the sea of posters. And I think that neuroscience is a very young area. I think it's still pre-Newtonian, so we are still lacking the fundamental principle. So we understand very well how single neuron works, but we do not understand very well what are the general principle guiding information processing in the brain. And I think that theoretical work, and in particular theoretical work inspired by deep learning, can really provide a guidance in discovering these fundamental principles of learning in the brain.
So you've done a lot of decision-making work, and you've recently, had this free energy principle push. When you get an idea as a modeler, as a theorist, how long do you chew on it before you actually start working on it? Do you like get out of the shower and immediately start modeling it? Or do you dry off first and maybe think about it for a few months?
Yeah, so I think that...
It's in between there.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think that I really jump on the ideas. I think that my wife would say that I make notes in very unusual moments sometimes and just jump out and just, we have to say, I have to make note of this and just try to, I think that when you have an idea, you don't really know if this idea works or not until you try it. And one amazing thing about like computational neuroscience is that you can try out ideas very quickly, that you can see if a particular model is correct by simulating it and seeing what it does within minutes or hours. I know that you work with monkey neurophysiology, where it takes really months to basically get results. So this is the appeal of the theoretical work.
Yes, I agree. And as you see, I'm retired, so I'm no longer doing that. So it drove me out, man. It drove me out. But you know, in business, like in startups and tech startups as well, you know, there's this mantra of failing fast and breaking things, fail forward. And this bias toward action, right? And on the theoretical side and on the experimental side and, you know, the academic side, you know, I wonder where that balance really is best between carefully thinking out and planning and just trying stuff. And it's easier. One of my colleagues, when I was doing monkey neurophysiology, he came for a stint in our lab, and he also did human EEG work. And I hated him. I mean, he's a great guy, but I hated him because in one day he could pilot an experiment and then just figure out whether it's worth pursuing. Anyway, all right, I'm done ranting here. So as a theorist, and you know, you having these ideas, I mean, do you have ideas that you could pass on? Like, what's one idea that you maybe don't have the resources or the focus or the funds, you know, even to do that you think that someone else should be doing right now?
Thank you for this question. So yes. So in fact, for example, in this paper, in our review in Transcognitive Science, we compare several models of deep learning implementation in the brain. But I think there's a need for someone to thoroughly compare them in simulation. So each author of each of this model simulated the model on a benchmark task, but the simulations were done in a different way. And you know, we try to kind of compare the learning times and the accuracy of these models, but you know, they are really not comparable. So it would be really great for, and I think this is a need in this field, to compare formally this different implementation of deep learning, how well they are doing in terms of their accuracy and in terms of their simulation time and training time. And of course, this shouldn't be done by me or any of the other authors of this model,
right,
to be unbiased. So I think that it would be really great if someone, maybe of the listeners, would like to take this challenge and just bring this comparison to the field.
That's a great idea because it's very straightforward and doable.
Yes, and another thing is that, so I mentioned that I'm particularly interested in the moment on trying to map this deep learning algorithms on the basal ganglia, because this is the area which I've been working on for the last 15 years. But there are also other areas of the brain which are relatively well understood. And I think that the next really interesting candidate is the hippocampus,
uh-huh,
where you know, we know quite well about the organization and physiology and properties of neurons. So I think it will be really interesting to see how you can map any of this algorithms or maybe their combination on the hippocampal system.
Okay, great. Man, two very worthy projects there. And hippocampus is really hot right now in, you know, talking to Tim Behrens recently and, you know, of course, all the place cell work. So, all right, that's great. So we talked about a little bit about this before, but I just want to get your opinion. If you have like a specific thought where AI in general and or deep networks are most lacking with respect to incorporating what we know about brains.
So I think that maybe the one such area is that is autonomy. So, you know, when you have these deep networks, you have to train them. You essentially have to provide a lot of assistance to them. And, you know, we as humans know what to do by ourselves. Yeah? So we make our decisions as agents just to satisfy our needs. We have different needs in different time. So it's really interesting to take inspiration from this and try to see if you can develop artificial systems which can also make decisions to satisfy the needs. And one such need is the need of knowledge. So, you know, we actually learn typically to achieve our goals. So in nature, we are learning not just to, you know, increase particular level of accuracy in the training set. We were learning to survive. And, you know, maybe in our modern life, you even create contingencies where, you know, learning is required to achieve certain goals. So, for example, my son really wants a BMX bike, but I set him a target on some mark from the school he needs to achieve in order to get his BMX bike. So essentially, so he has to do this kind of secondary supervised learning and memorize this, all these facts in order to achieve his goal. So I think that it's really important how you build systems which actually work autonomously in the world and try to extract information just to realize their goals.
But so that sounds like steps towards general AI almost. I mean, does that relate?
Yeah, I think it's closely related. Yes, because all organisms are really trying to find ways to solve their various problems they are faced with.
Good. Well, let's flip the question around, and I think I know maybe one or two words that you'll use when you answer this. I think you'll use maybe. I'm just going to guess here, and then you can intentionally not use these words if you can. I'm going to say the words efficiency and optimal or optimization. So the question then is where is neuroscience most lacking with respect to incorporating principles that have been learned from AI work?
Yes, so I think that you're absolutely right. So this is, yes, I can satisfy your, reduce the prediction error, right? And
right.
So yes, definitely the, you know, many of the models of which have been developed for the brain are not as efficient as artificial neural networks. So it's definitely a really great source of inspiration, all the technology which have been developed in deep learning. One such example, I think, is work in deep learning which have been done to make predictions in time and use time. So most of the models of biological backprop have been developed for static input patterns and static output patterns. But of course, we as living organisms have to make our decisions on the basis of the sequences of inputs, such as speech. We have to classify speech and we have to generate sequences of outputs, such as our movements. So it's really interesting to understand, you know, how this could be done efficiently. And of course, in machine learning, we have various tools like long, short-term memories. And there's a lot of kind of interest how things like this could be approximated in neural circuits. So I think this would be a particularly interesting insight on how we can achieve the efficiency seen in the deep systems.
I just talked to Francisco de Sousa Weber, and he actually runs a startup called Coracle.io, where he implements natural language processing in kind of a different way with these sparse distributed representations, but that does it, in time, can take text over time, essentially. And this is based off of work that Jeff Hawkins has done modeling our neocortex, and he specifically incorporates time into his networks. And it's different than a deep learning approach, but it's along those same lines.
Yes.
So that's interesting. Rafael, do you have a favorite general theory of brain functioning? You know, is it the free energy principle is that your favorite?
I will not disappoint you. Yes. So I'm a big fan of free energy principle developed by Carl Friston, and I think it's really fascinating because it provides a description of how the brain implements very efficient computation, how the brain implements Bayesian inference, but also describes it, how it can be done in a biologically plausible way in a network of simple elements, which look like neurons, which interact with each other. So it's a kind of, what's really beautiful about this free energy principle, that it combines the efficiency of computation with biological plausibility.
Hmm. But and, you don't think that they're... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, and, you know, Carl Friston has proposed that, you know, it can be applied to many different computations in the brain, not just to perceptions, but also to, you know, to action selection and so on. So I think, you know, he has promoted this as a general principle, and I also see it this way.
So one of the knocks on the free energy principle, from what I understand, is that you can almost accomplish anything, but every different thing that you accomplish has a large number of distinct constraints that you need, distinct assumptions that you need to make to accomplish any one given thing, right? So there aren't the same assumptions that encompass everything to accomplish multiple tasks. Does that make sense?
Yes, so I think that what's really interesting in this financial principle is that depending what assumptions you make about the distributions in the probabilistic model or about values priors, these different assumptions can give you different networks. And, you know, of course, what you have different parts of the brain which try to realize different functions. And I think it would be really interesting to see whether you can, you know, explain the differences in the anatomy of different parts of the brain in the different priors or assumptions put inside this free energy type models.
They could map directly on. That's really interesting. Okay, so just a couple more questions here, and I'll let you go. But what is something that is potentially crazy that you believe that we'll learn about our brains and or minds moving forward?
So, as I mentioned, I'm a big fan of the free energy principle. And one aspect of this free energy principle, which really sounds crazy, is an extension called active inference. So what active inference says is the following. So in general, the free energy principle could be viewed as saying that the brain is trying to minimize its surprise. So it's minimized the difference between what you see and what you expect to see. And the active inference says that the brain is using two ways to minimize the surprise. So you can either change your expectations to match your stimuli, if you have mismatch, and this corresponds to perception and learning, but you can also minimize the surprise in a different way, namely by changing the world to match your expectations.
Right.
So this would correspond to action. And this may sound really crazy, why you would basically minimize expectation by changing the world. But what you know, Carl proposed is that there are some expectations which should not be changed by evolution, should not be changed through learning. For example, an expectation that my food reserves are on a certain level. And if such expectations are not satisfied, then the brain finds a way to satisfy them by getting food. So I think this sounds like a really crazy principle, but I think that, you know, it may turn out to be a correct description of how we select actions.
It really is in line also with people like Daniel Wolpert's ideas that movement is the basis of all of our cognition anyway. So it makes a bit of sense that active inference idea of changing the world and taking action to make the predictions match your expectations fits in that realm too. So that's a really interesting approach, I think.
Yeah, it's also I like that idea. Connected, you know, with the you know, work of Matt Botvinnik on planning as inference. Yeah, so I think he also proposed that when you see that the reward is available, you take the reward as premise and you try to infer, you know, what actions you should take to get it.
And you think the law of future research is going to be based on this principle that that's the principle of, that drives us?
Yes. Yeah. So this is my 5-year grant, which I mentioned before.
Ah, yeah. Great. Well, lastly, thinking about the broad swath of what there is available to do right now, you're kind of deep into it. You're writing grants. You have this basal ganglia project as well. But if you were just starting off right now, think back of, I know you haven't made any mistakes, but all the mistakes that you've made, no mistakes. you know, how would you proceed? How would you get into this field of that straddles both neuroscience and AI? What advice would you give?
So in terms of like research direction, so I mentioned that, you know, I'm interested in this kind of subcortical areas, which are simple and I kind of know a lot about them. But I think that time becomes ripe now to try to address really the hard question of the cortical circuits. So I think it's, you know, thanks to these new technologies of optical imaging and circuit manipulation, we will soon have enough information to really try to understand this cortical circuit. So I will be, you know, still staying in the basal ganglia, which my colleague Pete McGills calls the basements of the brain. But I think that, you know, the really interesting final frontier is the cortex. And I think this is the place where it would be really interesting to try to map this algorithm on the 6 layers of the neocortex. And I hope that, you know, before not too long, someone will be able to do this.
Well, Rafael, this has been really fun, and I really appreciate your time. So I'll point people to that review paper in Trends in Cognitive Science and some of the other work that we talked about. Thanks again, and really, good luck on the 5-year grant. I wish you the best.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Brain Inspired is a production of me. You can support the show through Patreon for a trifling $2 or $4 per month. Go to patreon.com/braininspired or go to the website braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. Your contribution will help keep this show going without any annoying advertisements like you hear on other shows. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thank you for your support. See you next time. The stair-